I'm for going ahead and starting.
Yes.
I just talked with Angela, who is running Vespers tonight, and Vespers is in this location and starts at 7:15. I have my alarm set for 7:05. When my alarm goes off, I may finish that sentence and one more, but that'll be it. We have another 80 or 90 minutes together tomorrow during the mine hike, so if I don't mean to be abrupt tonight, but there may be some questions that I'll answer that one tomorrow. I probably already know the answer, but I just think there will be more time tomorrow, and even if I don't, it'll give me a chance to make up something better. So,
what time is it tomorrow?
10:50.
Thank you.
We're transitioning from general geology and my desire to convert you to the gospel of James Hutton. And now we're into the very technical and business world that I work in. I came here the first time on May 17th, 1997. That's the first boat ride I took, and came up here as part of a crew. Didn't know anything about this side of the creek and knew very little about the other side of the creek, but that was my focus. I was trying to make an estimate. I've probably been here for 6 months out of the last 11 years, 180 days, perhaps even more, on the business side of things, on the professional side of things, and then whatever else I've done on Elder Village and volunteer teaching staff. My profession is studying groundwater. I have been working on this project since 1997. I am what my company calls the hydrogeologist of record. I'm not really sure what that means, but since they only mention it when the lawyer's around, I think it's bad. Of all of the projects I have done in my career, this is the one that I am most tied into in ways other than professionally. If you can imagine having been here for 6 months over the last 11 years, having anywhere near the fun you've had this week. And this has been a really dull and boring week for me. Usually I have more fun than this, so.
Well, that's a lot.
Really.
That's a joke. But then the other part is, on a lot of those other weeks when I've been here, I've gotten paid a lot of money, so there's that. Had that going for it. So, all right, PowerPoint presentation now, mine hike tomorrow. The Holden Mine Site Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, a work in progress. I chose that title carefully to have both meanings. One is that it's a work in progress, as you can see. The first time I gave this talk was in July of 2002, and now we're up to the seventh edition of this talk. And hopefully it's a work in progress that we're trying to get somewhere.
Kind of like the federal government to go on.
Well, the federal government is involved. Okay, here are the topics I plan to cover, and some of these I'll do quite quickly because I think they're not as important as I used to think they were, but here's the introduction. We're going to talk about the mine site. We're going to talk about the early investigation history. We're going to talk about the current sort of legal and political framework, which relates to the Superfund process. The schedule to date, the last time I revised this very thoroughly was in 2004, so you'll be able to see how ludicrous my time guesses were in 2004. The remedial investigation work completed, a site model, which is, if you can think, how do we describe this valley in five sentences, and then the key findings of the remedial investigation. Disclaimer, I am a consultant, so I come prepared with a disclaimer. The first one is I strive to be objective, and at the same time, I'm being paid by the mining company. When I graduated
my first degree in 1981, I was sure that I was completely objective. I was 24 at the time, and somewhere along the line, maybe in my mid-30s, I realized from 24 to 35 what I had been doing was jumping to a conclusion that I wanted and then filling in the facts behind it. I hopefully don't do that anymore. So you should take everything I say with a grain of salt, but you should take everything anybody else says with a grain of salt too. The second point that I was going to make is, in this case, I am here, and although I have this professional knowledge, I'm not a representative of URS at this moment, or of Intalco, or House Sound Mining. So hopefully if this is being taped, that gets me off the hook for being sued for anything I say.
My objective is to summarize eight years and 30,000 hours, which is now up to 12 years and perhaps 100,000 hours of work, into 62 minutes, so that you can add to your understanding of the site history, the process of the environmental investigation, and if you want, become an informed participant on future decisions affecting Holden Village and the local environment. This is directed a little bit more towards the long-term staff, but you, as well as visitors to Holden Village and people who might want to come back again, have a say at a certain point in this ongoing process where your voice can be heard. Here's a series of bullet points that talk about the mine site. The ore body was discovered by Holden in 87. He was a surveyor working for the railroad, trying to find a route to put a railroad. That never worked out, but the story goes that he was out hunting deer and shot one that fell down on where the ore body is. Howe Sound mined here from 38 to 57. Copper and zinc were the primary metals. Mine also produced gold and silver. There are 60 miles of underground mine workings. There are 8 million tons. Actually, the piles cover about 65 acres. When we came into the project in 1997, we had sort of always heard that they were 90 acres, and we believed that all along, and then we finally did an aerial survey and said, oh, that's 65. Cyanide was used sparingly in the first year the mine operated as part of the gold process, the gold removal process, and that was the only time it was used. At various years when I've been coming up and riding on the boat, the Forest Service guide would say that arsenic was used in the mining process. Here, that's not correct. So, 2,000 tons a day of ore was removed. The ore was processed and concentrated at the mill building, and then 200 tons a day of concentrate were produced, so 90% reduction in mass, or mass in this case. The tailings were placed on the tailings piles, and then the concentrate went down the road that we still use to Lucerne, and then barge to Chelan, and then by truck to the railhead, and then to Tacoma by rail for smelting. This is a map of the watershed, the Railroad Creek watershed. So anything that falls, any rainfall or snowfall that falls inside that black line comes towards the Holden mine site. And the black square there is the village, and the tailings piles are on the other side of the creek. Railroad Creek is the bottom of the valley, so it's the ultimate drain. So any rainfall that falls inside the line comes to Railroad Creek. Anything falling outside the line goes to another drainage. Here is a more detailed map of some of the mine-related features. Holden Village is the small triangle up at the top of the page in the center. There are three big tailings piles, and at some point in Holden history, they were known as, they had biblical names attached to them. I can't remember that. But somewhere along the line, we got to calling them Tailings Pile 1, 2, and 3. Tailings Pile 2 is the very tall one that's in the middle. The shaded and hatched pattern are the waste rock piles. I'll have a photo of those in a moment. This is a map of the surface and then some overlays or underlays of the various mine levels, which of course we all know were found in metamorphosed sedimentary rock
trending north-20-west and dipping 70 to the southwest. Right.
Right.
Or at least the Holden Elder Village people know that. For those of you who have missed that, you'll just have to catch up some other time.
This is an aerial photo of that same map area. Here's the village. Here are those big, here's the big tall tailings pile, the middle tailings pile two. If I say TP2, I'm thinking tailings pile two. Tailings pile one, and here are those waste rock piles again. One thing to notice, here's Railroad Creek coming, flowing along. Here is the pedestrian bridge. Here is Copper Creek coming in. Here's Railroad Creek and Railroad Creek exiting sort of the mine site. Railroad Creek right here, the stream bed we can see. What color is it?
White.
White.
Gray.
What do we see it as down here?
Brown.
Rust red. And right about here, right at the corner of Tailings Pile 1, up until that point, if you walk up that way to the footbridge and you stand on the footbridge and you look at the bed, you'll see it as being white and gray and things like that. If you walk down to the far end, to the Goat Bridge or Sven's Bridge, you stand there and you see the same rocks just covered really in rust, but in a dark reddish orange color. That is related to the iron, which is released from the tailings piles. The first effect we see of that is I'm hoping tomorrow that we can hike up to the corner of Tailings Pile 1 and look down and see that in the creek. There's a view up valley from the top of the waste rock pile, a classic U-shaped glacially carved valley. The valley that holds Holden Lake is right up here, another glacially carved U-shaped valley. Just because there's cool geology doesn't also mean it's a pretty nice picture. This is a picture from the top of the tailings pile looking up at the waste rock pile. Waste rock is material that wasn't milled, and in this case where tunnels were dug in to get to the ore body, that rock was not worth anything, so they just tucked it aside. And miners, being either really efficient or really lazy, throw junk the first closest place they can find it until that's filled up, and then they find the next closest place they can throw junk, and that's where they put it. So there's the mill building in between the two waste rock piles right there, or the ruins of the mill building, anyway. In 2000, we reestablished the main portal, which is where the majority of miners entered the mine and where all the ore came out. The main portal collapsed back in the early 60s, I think, so that an avalanche or the material above slumped down so that you couldn't get into the mine. To be able to get access to the mine to go inside to do some scientific studies, and with the idea that at some point in the future any remedial option would need to deal with the water coming out of the mine, we decided to reestablish a viable entrance to the mine. In this case, this is the place where the water leaks out of the mine. The mine was I'll have a slide about this in a moment. The lowest workings inside the mine are below creek level. They pulled the plug in 1958, turned the power off. Prior to that, they had big pumps, and the pumps are still down there, but they had operating pumps that were keeping the mine water drawn down. And from 1958 until 1963 or 64, the mine filled up to this point, and then the bathtub overtops, and now it continually overtops at this location. And that drainage flows somewhere from 50 gallons a minute in the winter to maybe 500 gallons, 400 gallons in the spring. These are a couple of more photos of the actual hard rock miners. These are guys that we had come in from, I think, Montana, maybe Idaho. There's a guy driving a low boy with a scoop on the end so they could go in and muck out stuff. inside that portal, about 150 feet in, is a V-notch weir that we built so that we could calculate how much water is coming out of the mine, a bulkhead with a weir cut into it. We have a monitoring device on the back side of the weir that we can measure the height of this water, and we can measure the pressure on that transducer and calculate how much water is coming out. This is me getting paid. As you go back further in the mine, there are places that have that we have accessed in 2000 and probably 2002. A lot of collapse. Here's a guy inside the mine near the main shaft. There's a photo looking down the main shaft. This is back out from the portal, look from one of the waste rock, top of one of the waste rock piles. This is the first tailings pile, and then the second one, the third one is hidden behind it. Because it's lower, we can't see it. Looks like a fall photo to me, using my keen sense of observation. This is the ruins of the old mill building. The top level of the mill building was at the 1500 level so that the ore cart trains could come right out and dump to the top of the mill building. And again, miners being efficient or lazy helped use gravity to help sort the rocks on the way down. They would crush at the higher levels and then concentrate in the lower levels. This is a view down from probably the east waste rock pile. That's a cell that we dug in the earliest 2001. And the one thing to note, to me, the point of that is not really very big, but here is a hole that we've dug inside the tailings pile. And what do we see? It's our observation that edges the top 4 to 5 feet of the tailings pile are orange, and then you get into sort of this gunmetal gray colored stuff. If you think that those are big piles of orange stuff, that's not correct. If you think those are big piles of blue gray stuff that have an orange rind around them, that's a better view, to my point, or to my way of thinking of it. That orange is simply rusting. That's the iron in the tailings material being oxidized, rusting like a nail does when you have it out in the weather. When did the mine shut down? 1958, 50 years ago. In 50 years, those, let's say it's been 5 feet of rusting of the tailings. That's a foot per 10 years, right? My math good? You with me? Mm-hmm. A foot per 10 years with a 120 foot thick tailings pile two, what's the math there? If the rate is constant, that pile will have rusted from top to bottom in about 1200 years. So we can all come back here for, we can come back for the 1208th edition of this talk and go check.
Now, did you guys find it to be drying up at all, or is it just sitting there holding that water such that below the water level it's not going to oxidize?
No, we have taken water levels, we have wells in the tailings, and the water level in the tailings, the perhaps bottom 10 feet of the tails are saturated. So, this is the road that goes out to the vehicle bridge. So if you've been to the vehicle bridge and looked up that road, you kind of know where this pond is. If not, go walk out there and find it yourself.
There's a bridge in
it. That greenish tint of the water suggests that there's copper in there. That's a ponded area that forms every spring and then dries out by the summertime. Naming of the mine levels, the zero level is where the ore body intercepts the surface, and so level identification is the number of vertical feet down from the zero level.
bigger numbers mean lower elevation. I think this should be changed. If Jim was here, we'd edit this and get rid of that. That main portal is at the 1,500 foot level, so it's 1,500 vertical feet down from the ore outcrop. The lowest level was 2,675, so below Railroad Creek. Up on the hillside are a number of other waste rock piles from the mine, the early mine workings. And this is the 1,100 waste rock pile. This is the 800 foot waste rock pile. And yesterday, one of my coworkers and I hiked up and did some work at those. So again, we hiked from the 1,500 level, we hiked another 400 vertical feet to the 1,100, and then another 300 to get up to the 800. So if I'm moving slow, particularly tomorrow, that's why that'll be. Early environmental investigation and remediation history. I'm not going to go through this very thoroughly, only we can, you know, put a couple of time stamps on. The first time that anything was done here was in 1963. I guess that 1967, GW means groundwater, both the portal and from the tailings piles, and SW is surface water. They found iron, copper, zinc, and manganese elevated in Railroad Creek and found absence. How do you find absence? Noted the absence of fish and aquatic insect fauna downstream of the tailings piles. In 1989, 1990, and 1991, the Pacific Northwest Laboratories, who were a subcontractor to the Forest Service, did some original work here. Dug some diversion trenches around the back of the tailings piles, put riprap at the base, and put the gravel on top of the tailings piles, and also developed an environmental monitoring plan. And then in the early 1990s, there were additional studies done, including by the U.S. Geological Survey, a guy named Jim Kilbert. Dames and Moore was a predecessor company to URS, and that's who I was working with back in 1997. So we've been involved since then, and I don't know if things are going better or not. The regulatory framework here, the Holden Mine site is not a Superfund site. In order to become a Superfund site, a site has to go through what's called a listing process, which takes into account the severity and the scope of any contamination. This is not the case here. However, the Forest Service and the Washington State Department of Ecology, which is the Washington State EPA, agreed with Intalco, the people who owned the liability at the time, that they would follow the Superfund process. That we wouldn't list it as a site, but we would follow that process. Because that process is very structured and has a certain set of pieces to it, the whole point was, all right, we have this process called the Superfund process. Let's not recreate the wheel. Let's go with something that is well established and people have agreed to. So here are components of the Superfund process. An administrative order on consent, which is a legal document that says thou shalt, well, nah, that's a religious document. You will do various things. If not, there are penalties that can accrue. A remedial investigation. To simplify this, like I do sometimes, this is what are the problems? A feasibility study. How can we fix the problems? A record of decision. This is, again, another legal document that is created by the Forest Service that says, here are the site conditions, here are the facts, here is what the Forest Service is requiring Intalco to do, and if not, here are the penalties. And then after that, remedial activities, which will be come up here and do something. Here's the schedule to date. This we can just go through very quickly. Again, the first time I presented this was in July of 2002, and
I have some highlights here as of 2004, so that remedial action construction begins in the spring of 2004. Mm-hmm. No. In 2004, I said it was going to be 2006. Here we are in 2008. And I will admit that I have an 11-year long record of being perfectly wrong about the path of the project. Which is harder than, like, you know, even if you were just sort of throwing darts at labels on a wall every now and again, you'd think you'd be right, right? I mean, just by accident. But I'm not really proud of it, but over a decade I've never been right. So that's the end of the first half of this. While I'm firing up the second half, are there questions that I can answer? Please, somebody.
That wasn't a question.
I have a question. Is there any danger of tailings piles collapsing, or have they reached their angle of repose?
Since David's not here to be my straight man, thank you for taking that role. In the next 25 slides, we'll get the answer to that. How about that?
That's pretty cool. All right. Cool. Donna? Mm-hmm. Were the Forest Service actions helpful for the environment? Did we get some benefit from those? Did you say they rerouted some things and covered things with gravel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Prior to, if that isn't answered in the next 25 slides, remind me again. I promise I will tell you.
Donna?
Yes.
The material that they put on the tops of the tailings at each level, all the gravel and all of that, where did all of that come from?
That came from a quarry which is uphill from the top of the switchbacks on the way up here. And a gravel pit, which is downhill, Dan's camp, that the village folks may be familiar with. Mm-hmm. There was a gravel operation that, and the very tail end of that is still visible down there.
Did they have to bring in a crusher or anything, or was it pretty much be able to just dig right out of the hillside and it would break up small enough to where they could just transport it up here and spread it?
The gravel that they placed on top of the piles, I think all they did was sort that.
Okay.
The granite, the big stuff that came out of the quarry is the stuff they've used as the riprap at the base of the tailings pile. So I don't know how they got that out of there. I suppose they had to blast it. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I mean, they were trying to get as big a chunks out of there as they could, or big enough to use as riprap, which is, you know, 2-foot diameter or 3-foot diameter boulders that they would put at the base of the tailings piles to keep the stream or the creek from eroding away the base of the tailings pile. Okay. All right, remedial investigation work completed. We did a whole bunch of stuff, a whole number of different things related to surface water, groundwater, soils, human health risk, risk for animals, tailings pile slope stability. We did a bat survey. Again, these additional well lysimeter installations in 2001 and 2003 were completed, and I haven't updated since then. And then from May 15th until the end of August, Deb, when did the...
Yeah.
We had a crew up here of anywhere from 8 to 20 people and spent another $1.5 million trying to get more data that we needed. So, and now, two of my coworkers are here. There were another pair. This is Bill and Claire, and they've been out walking around in the forest looking at the big trees that may need to come down as part of the remediation.
Okay.
So that's another thing that'll get added here next year. I won't credit them personally, but.
Only if they let me come.
This is another one of my coworkers, Karen. We are sampling a groundwater monitoring well. You've seen these things probably sticking out all over the place. This is a well that's drilled down into the subsurface that we pump water out of and test and send to a lab to be analyzed. That's another friend of mine from 1997 doing some sampling down by Railroad Creek below Tailings Pile 2. That's consultants, consultant. That's me. Let's see, what am I doing?
Cross sections?
I'm measuring the flow of Railroad Creek down below the tailings piles in probably October. You can see the frost on the trees behind me. And that's me collecting a sample of the water to figure out how much metal is moving down the stream at any point in time. You need to know two things: how much water there is and what's the concentration of the copper in the water, and you multiply those two together and you get a mass load. That's a group of us in the fall of 1997 shocking fish to do a fish survey so that we could compare and see what the population of fish was above the mine site and below the mine site. And we also went up to Stehekin and looked at some of the creeks there to use as sort of background or reference stations. So everybody at this point has their eyes down on the water looking for fish. Here's some guys inside the mine, so that's post 2000, doing some geology. Both of them got Brunton compasses out. This is a 2001 or 2003 picture. This is putting the drill rig, that's a track mounted drill rig with an air compressor, on the barge down in Chelan, coming up the lake so that we can do some drilling. That's a drill rig in place. Here we are installing monitoring wells down probably by Sven's Bridge. It's raining and cold, and I didn't like those days. This is up on top of the tailings piles doing some more work, and that's looking at copper behind the rigs. This is me doing serious technical work. You think I may just be pouring water down the hole? In fact, what I'm doing is pouring water down the hole. But I'm keeping track of how much water goes in a certain period of time, and by knowing that, we can figure out kind of what the permeability of the stuff is. I should be wearing a hard hat, and I'm not, and that's too bad. Okay, here's the site model. If there are three things that I want you to know about the model, first is the site is located in a glacially carved U-shaped valley. We saw that picture as we were looking up the valley. If it's a stream-carved valley, it will typically be a very sharp V. The glacier comes in and turns that into a U. The valley bottom and the lower sidewalls are covered with soil and sediments of glacial origin, some of which are reworked by Railroad Creek. The glacier went up and down this valley countless times, I don't know how many, and in between times, the material would fall down into the valley, and then the glacier would come and ram it up against the sidewalls or scrape it along the sides where we saw those gouge marks yesterday. And the third thing, all site surface water and groundwater is ultimately discharged to Railroad Creek. Railroad Creek is the lowest point in the valley. Stuff flows downhill, water included, so Railroad Creek is the drain of the valley. I guess if there were one more thing I would want you to think of, my buddy Rick, who works on this project, says that the valley is a bathtub full of marbles. I think of it as more being a half round pipe full of marbles and dirt, but the bottom of the pipe is washboardish. When we first got here in the early days, we thought it was fairly flat, that the permeable material was of relatively the same thickness everywhere.
as we have done more science, we have found that that's not the case very much at all, that the permeable material ranges anywhere from 20 feet thick to 130 feet. One of the ways that we did some testing is by using geophysics, where we put a number of microphones that would sense the sound waves coming from the ground, and then we blew up some dynamite and sent shock waves through the material and came up with a map that showed these numbers are how fast sound waves travel through this material, 12,500 feet per second or 14,000 feet per second. The denser and more compact the material, the faster the sound will move through it. So in this case, there's no geology associated with this. All that the geophysicists can tell us is these various layers, some of which transmit sound waves very quickly and some of which don't. So now it's up to us to go and drill some holes and figure out what each of those units is comprised of. And in this case, this is bedrock material for you Holden Elder Village folks. Some of it is metamorphic and some of it is igneous, depending on where we are. This is the overlying, these are the marbles, this is the bathtub. These are marbles that have a lot of dirt associated with them, though. Okay, remedial investigation, key findings, site conditions. There are two distinct groundwater chemistries at the site. Zinc and copper water from the portal and the mill area, and iron water from the tailings piles. When we hike tomorrow and we walk across the footbridge, that's about the dividing line in the site. Anything up that way from the pedestrian bridge is zinc and copper water. Anything coming this way, we start to get iron. The spring runoff conditions for both volume and chemistry are different than conditions for the remainder of the year. This is a hydrograph of Railroad Creek at the footbridge. A hydrograph is here's time on the x-axis, and here is how much water comes down the creek on the y-axis. These cubic feet per second, that's 1 cubic foot per second of water going past a spot. This is the number that I was calculating in the first of the two photos. And this is not particularly relevant, but you can see that during the winter and the spring, this number is something like 80, and then during the spring runoff, the number gets to be almost 700, 650. And again, this is fully dependent on how much snow they've had the winter before, and how sharp this curve is depends on this. I suspect there was a little early hot weather, and then it got cold again, so there was not a lot of snow melt. And then around whatever date that is, 1st of June, it got hot again, and the creek went bananas. This happened to be while we were out there working in those 3 days of rain that we put the wells in. It rained for 3 days straight, and the creek came up again to a level it hadn't been in a few months. Here's a picture of the cross-section of the mine. This black stuff is the backfilled part of the mine. They did, in the latest days of work here, try to push some of the tailings back into the mine. Again, the problem there is you're trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube. It doesn't all go back in there. And the other part from my concern, from the groundwater concern, is now water is in contact with those tailings. As long as there's not any oxygen back there, there's not a problem. But if there is, then you get bad water coming out of the portal. Okay. Remedial investigation key findings. The ones that we talked about before, particularly about the dual water chemistry, that's an observation. Here we've moved from simple observations into potential environmental concerns. Seasonal exceedances of water quality criteria occur in surface water. That's in Railroad Creek. Metals concentration decrease as stream flow decreases. If somebody reminds me of that tomorrow, I'll tell you why that is. And so there are a number of exceedances in the spring. By fall, the exceedances are limited. Seasonal exceedances of water quality criteria occur in groundwater at the site. This is not a big deal because we're not likely to ever use groundwater as a drinking water source at this site. The water that we drink and bathe in comes from up in Copper Basin. And so in this case, those criteria or those exceedances in groundwater are not terribly important in the groundwater. However, because the groundwater discharges into the surface water, that's where the problem comes in. Both benthic invertebrate and fish populations are reduced downstream of the site. Fish populations 3 miles downstream are within the range of populations. Benthic invertebrate populations are reduced to the mouth of Railroad Creek. When we did the fish shocking 3 miles downstream, I forget what the number was. It was, you know, 20 fish up at the ball field and 15 or 16 fish downstream. Those are not precisely the same number, but they may be statistically the same. The benthic macroinvertebrate, which are the stuff that the fish eat, that population gets decreased by about 90%. And that population doesn't come back all the way down to the mouth of Railroad Creek at the lake. The tailings pile, tailings pile slopes facing Railroad Creek are relatively stable under static conditions. However, the tailings could be released in the event of a moderate earthquake. The computer modeling that we've done to this point up until this year showed that under sort of the worst case conditions, springtime, when those tailings might have water in them and might have a little bit of uplift pressure, and an earthquake, there is the possibility, and I think what the model talks about is not the entire 120 feet of tailings pile two is going to over into the creek, but there will be a slice, a wedge, come off probably the top of TP2 because it will sway more, that may go into the creek. I don't know that any modeling has been done to suggest what the impact on the village will be there. That's hard for me to see that happening would cause some dam that would cause flooding in the village. If there is going to be a lake formed behind it until there's enough water to blow that stuff down the creek, but then you've got the environmental, I don't think it's a nightmare, but the cleanup would be a nightmare. You have this discharge of tailings that if you were tasked with cleaning that up, that'd be a hard job. What else? Some surface and subsurface soils within the maintenance yard and lagoon area exceed regulatory criteria. This is small potatoes. That's a guy out there with a backhoe, and in 2 days we can have that taken care of. One sample collected at the Lucerne Bar, which is a not a drinking place, but the place where the sediment comes out, contains zinc at concentration slightly above the regulatory criteria. Conceptual potential remedial alternatives. This is something that the village staff knows very much more about because this has been a huge topic, particularly in the last year. Keep clean water clean by using the diversion trenches. The diversion trenches that the Forest Service dug were a good idea, they're just not nearly big enough. Collect and divert and treat seeps and runoff through manual addition of lime, create waterfalls to oxygenate, finish, and constructed wetlands. Regrade the tailings piles to take away that sliver that might come down. And the potential exists to divert Railroad Creek. That's what Bill and Claire are doing here. Is looking at the trees to that may be in those alignments. At this point, as of May 1st this year, there were two competing alternatives, one favored by the Forest Service and one favored by the mining company. The one favored by the mining company is one that includes relocating Railroad Creek further to the north, starting at about the fire pit, which is right down below the school here. Sorry, it's going to come right through here. That will still be the creek side room. This will be the creek top room. That's true. It will be diverted, pushed north, And the current drainage will be used as a collection trench to collect water coming from beneath the tailings piles. This stuff will all go down to the Svensbridge or Goat Bridge area and be treated in a fairly low-tech fashion with a water wheel that will dispense base material, calcium pellets, that will then react with the water. The water will be oxygenated, and there will be a series of ponds down by, again, just past the east tailing or the tailings pile three. That's the key piece of the plan the mining company favors. What the Forest Service would like to see happen is along the entirety of the tailings piles and probably upstream, a subsurface wall be built at the base of the tailings piles that is either partially penetrating or fully penetrating down to bedrock, anywhere from 20 to 130 feet deep, that would pond up water behind it, trap water behind it. That water would all be siphoned underneath Railroad Creek, and a treatment plant would be built again right when we came into the village, or when we leave the village. There's a road that goes off to the right, kind of down in that whole lower wooded area there. There would be a full-on a treatment plant like a municipality would use, only it would be focused on getting metals out of the water. There would be a full-time certified wastewater treatment plant operator be here. That's complicated and I don't want to talk about it. That shows a map that shows, here's again an idea of how we would divert water. Keeping clean water clean, I said, is one of the good conceptual ideas. Don't let anything, if you can divert clean water around the tailings piles and never let it get gooped up in the first place, that's a really low-tech alternative. It works every year. You don't have to do anything other than keep the trenches open. And this is a photo I took off the balcony or the upstairs of Lodge 1. In November of 01, I think, sunrise at Holden Village. And then we went out and drilled in the cold, crummy rain. So at least this part of the day was nice. That's all I got. So, now, go ahead.
When do you expect a decision will be made as to whose plan is put into effect? I know you have 11 years of not getting this right.
Okay, I wanted to be sure you were here for that part of the talk. This is a personal opinion, and I got to be right sooner or later. Right? Just because you flip a coin and it's been tails 100 times in a row, that still means the next time you flip it, it's still a 50-50 chance, right? So for the last 3 or 4 years, the two sides have been fighting. Part of what has allowed that, this is totally personal opinion. This is not related to this.
Another disclaimer.
The station is not responsible for the comments of any particular whatever they say on radio. Part of what has allowed the fighting to occur and the lack of progress over the last 4 years has been a lack of information. And so the two plans that came out both seem to some degree feasible based on the scanty data that we have. We collected a ton of new, I was going to say another word, but I can't say that here, a whole bunch. Again, we had 20 people here off and on, maybe more at some points, for months and spent $1.5 million, with the key focus of that investigation being how are these construction elements going to work? Is what we put on the paper back in the office, and we've had our dueling PowerPoint presentations, How is that going to work in the real world? How is it going to work at Holden Village? 20 feet of snow a year, everything coming in by barge, whatever other, you know, I don't know if Lutherans are particularly bad at mechanical stuff, but that I it's hard saying. And I don't know whether that was, anyway. We can't, to go back to seriousness for just a second, we can't still be fighting 3 years from now. The data that we have collected have to direct us towards one or the other, or a hybrid, or perhaps a new plan. There are some things that I saw early in the summer that suggest that both of the plans that have been put forward at this point may have a problem with them. And that, again, I understood, all of the data that we collected this summer would be turned over to the Forest Service and their consultants on Halloween. And
special day.
Well, by the end of October. The remedial investigation was, what are the problems? And from 1998 until this year, we were using the sort of what are the problems data set to try to figure out how to fix things. What we got this year was the how to fix things data set. And so, again, part of what allowed the last 4 years of lack of progress is we didn't have the stuff we needed. And now maybe we got 85% of it. We may get the rest of it next spring and move forward.
And is Intalco wholly liable for fixing all this? Is the state of Washington at all?
Intalco has agreed in the AOC that they will fund the remediation.
Okay.
They have funded the investigation to this point, not only from their subcontractor side, but the other side as well. The Forest Service people, I don't know whether the Forest Service people are working on their own dime, but their consultants are being paid by the mining company. The
Forest Service is paid too by Intalco.
Forest Service is paid by Intalco. So, go ahead, Keith.
I think my question is partially answered, but let me ask it this way. For how long is someone responsible for what was done here 50 years ago? In other words, Intalco, we think, is now owned by someone else. And is there a diminution of responsibility the further you get away from the original owners?
I don't think that to be the case, simply because that chain of title, I don't know if that's the right, anyway, it's not, there is no confusion that when Alumet bought Intalco, they got this. And there is no confusion that when Pechenet bought Alumet and when Canadian Aluminum bought Pechenet, that those things are all, that's
part of the package. Yeah.
That's, okay. That's a hydrogeologist's perspective on high legal matters. So,
but then did they get to argue over which is the cheaper of the solutions?
Well, the two solutions that were proposed as of last year, the one that the client favors is around $80 million. The one that the Forest Service favors is around $140 million. That's the last numbers I had, anyway.
And who decides, Tom?
Well, again, this is my understanding of things. The Forest Service essentially gets to decide. If there is something so egregious about the Forest Service decision in the eyes of the mining company I think, again, my understanding all along has been that the AOC, the Administrative Order on Consent, has a clause in it for essentially binding arbitration. That the way it's been described to me is the Forest Service and their team and their plan show up for one day and present to the judge, and Intalco and their team and their proposal come in the next day and present to the judge, and he decides. It's not a at that point, it's not a compromise. It's not a, no, you guys have to go back and talk more. It's a you win, you lose. And so if the Forest Service demands $1 billion remediation here, I think the expectation is that Intalco would say, or Intalco is the term I use for them, they would say, see in court, no judge is ever gonna, what, Intalco was ready to spend $40 or $60 million 5 years ago. So, go ahead, please.
He said that the Forest Service is paid by Intalco?
Yes.
Doesn't that compromise their decisions in some way?
No, in this case, what they do is they send Intalco a bill for the hours that they've spent. There's no, that's okay. Not a, there is no,
conflict of interest.
Yeah, no conflict.
What the relationship is purely financial. And damn, if that would have worked, we should have gotten more for our money than we've been getting so far. We still got 10 minutes, so come on, let's go. Let's have a good question. The reason, no, these have all been excellent. I want to go back to technical questions because I'm less liable to get in trouble for those. The reason that with the spring runoff, the concentrations actually get higher, that's a little bit counterintuitive. You would think that if the contaminant load is the same all the time and you get a bunch of clean water coming into the system, that the concentration should go down. That's not the case, particularly in the portal, because as those water levels rise in 1 year and then drop off again, or rain and snowmelt comes down and essentially washes the sides of the mine clean. And then that happens during the spring flush, and then from say July 1st of 1 year until May 1st of the following year, those walls of the mine are essentially rusting again. Only rather than it being an iron thing that forms on the edges, it's more a copper and zinc thing, and then it gets washed out again every year. So there's a big, we find that fairly commonly in mine sites, that there is, with that first flush of water, you get a whole slug of really pretty contaminated water, or in comparison to the remainder of the year, that's the highest concentration water that you would get. Go ahead.
What is the consistency of the tailings? Are they like small rocks? Are they like baseball-sized rocks? Do they go into different gradations of size?
They go, if we'd had done another day on rocks, we would have talked about grain size, and it's shown on your handout. In your handout packet, there's on one page there are a couple of cards, or a true size representation of a card, and then a blow up of it that says X log on it. That was what I used when I was working in the oil business. The size is silt and fine sand. So fine sand is sugar size. So if you and this was material that was at the end of the milling process, so anything that was baseball sized got caught by a set of forks and got routed out again and went up and got crushed again, and they wanted to get the particles as small as they feasibly could to be able to float the ore off of them. So those tailings piles, I was out there. I could have brought you some tailings on my clothes because I was out there all afternoon or after lunch trying to collect some of this material. And yeah, when you climb it, it's like climbing up sand and or rock table sugar and smaller size stuff. So there is some, and within the tailings piles, kind of going from the edges to the middle, the grain size decreases because the way the tailings were placed was in a series of pipes that went around the edges of the tailings piles. And so the coarser material settled out closer to the edges. And then as the water slowed down, that's when the finer material was dumped out. Go ahead, please.
Are there other mines out there that have been addressed in this way? And can we use, if so, can we use that data as, just can we look at data from other mines?
Yes. That, as part of that feasibility study process, that's another one of those let's not reinvent the wheel things, right? The feasibility study process is, all right, we've decided what the problems are, what are the ways that these have been addressed? And so we came up, the team came up with a list of alternatives from one, don't do anything, to nine at the time, which was all the bells and whistles. Grading in cost from $500,000 to whatever, $60 million at the time. And those were based on a variety of hybrids of different things to do. Are we going to, is a waste rock pile, does that have enough contamination in it that we should build a wall at the base of that and collect water and treat that? Using each of the components, and that one slide that I sort of skipped over sort of showed which are the biggest sources of contamination. We would want to sort of get the most bang for our buck. If I've got a cut finger and my leg is about cut off too, I'm going to bleed out from this thing before I am for this, so let's tend to that first. So that the techniques are, you know, nobody's come up with some new solution that's going to win them the Nobel Prize. It's, yeah, these are all standard things. It's just how do we put them in various combinations? What's the cost? What's the political? Here's a thing that I will commit to, even because if the geochemists were in charge of this, the right place for those tailings is at the bottom of Lake Chelan. Now, try to, sorry?
Yeah, get you in the 1,200-foot trench.
Yes.
Really?
Absolutely. Get them out of the oxygen, leave those blue tailings blue. That lake never turns over. Whatever's down at the bottom, it'd kind of be sorry to be them. That's the best place for them. But I can start the political movement tomorrow to put tailings at the bottom of Lake Chelan, and let's see how... You thought... 10 years of nothing going on was a lot. Put me in charge of things, and I'll. That again, there are technical solutions that are appropriate. That politics say isn't going to happen at all.
Donna?
Yes.
Okay. If and or when Railroad Creek would be moved. Okay, you're speaking roughly from this point downstream to around Smith Bridge?
Yes.
Somewhere in that area?
Yes.
Okay, of course, River Creek, even below Smith Bridge for quite a ways, is still the red rock that you see that's all coated below that.
Yes.
If River Creek were rerouted, would anything be done to the stream channel below that point, or would the water that's now flowing through the new stream channel over the years reduce that reddishness or break it up or whatever to minimize the effects of all of this that's been happening in Railroad Creek below that point?
To my knowledge, it would be the second of those, that it would be sort of natural attenuation, and not having a new input of iron every year, because that water would be collected in the old alignment and be treated over the next 100 years, that whether that iron staining would go away. I don't think there's any plan to change that simply for the aesthetics of it.
Can I add to that from an ecological standpoint?
You can do it as long, no, you can't, as a matter of fact. You can talk to Clay upstairs in the dining hall after Vespers and have a bowl of cereal.
Okay.
So that's all I got because Angela's here and
I am sorry.
No, there's no need to be sorry.